I have to ask. Okay, so HTE is great, but I think that there's also a component of having this like mental toughness, I guess, artist. So like what are your skills for like staying strong and motivated while trying to find that needle?
Hi, I'm LC, and I'm a storyteller. I'm a passionate chemist who loves to explore and tell stories about how chemistry can change the world.
And I'm Danny, and I'm LC's spirited chemistry co-host. I love to bring high energy and positivity to my chemistry, but also my life. Welcome to the Farm to Table podcast.
We're two chemists working at the pharmaceutical company Merck in the U.S.,
also known as MSD, everywhere else in the world except Canada, the U.S., and its territories.
And this is a podcast where we'll tell you stories about the people and the science behind the papers published by our chemistry group.
Each week, we'll pick one to two papers that we've recently published and introduce you to the key people behind it, and also ask them to give you a unique insight into the story behind it. Welcome, folks. Today we're here with Dan DiRocco and Artis Clappers to talk about two papers, one from Science in 2017 and another more recently published article in Chemical Science that was in 2021. Dan, welcome to the podcast and also Artis. Dan, you first. Would you mind introducing yourself, give a little bit of background, who you are, what you do at Merck, and maybe a fun fact?
Sure. Yeah, I'm Dan DiRocco. I'm in the process chemistry organization in Rahway, New Jersey. I've been at Merck about 9.5 years now. I started my career at Merck in the catalysis group originally, and that was, you know, more of a tech group working on catalytic methods. And actually, the stuff that we're going to talk about today was actually done at that time when I was in that group. I then moved into more traditional process chemistry sort of leadership role. I'm a project lead for a late stage development program right now. I'm working on a sort of late stage manufacturing route that's currently undergoing piloting. Before Merck, I did my PhD with Tom Rovis at Colorado State before he moved to Columbia. And my PhD was mostly in sort of organocatalysis, if you will, and heterocyclic carbene. Asymmetric chemistry. And I work mostly in that field and a little bit of photoredox catalysis before I came to Merck, and I came directly out of Tom's group to Merck. I guess one quick fun
it's
fact.
It's kind of like organocatalysis a little bit there, right?
It's yeah, that's right.
are recording this the week of the Nobel, so that's a little nod to that.
It sounds like you might have wanted to pick a different advisor. No, just saying.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't trade that. I really enjoyed Tom. Maybe a fun fact about myself. I used to be a pretty good banjo player. I'm a little rusty these
days.
Yeah,
right.
I was back in Colorado. We used to get together and with a couple other people that played other instruments and play some bluegrass. So that's always been a favorite kind of pastime of mine.
Banjo
that's so
Dan.
Cool. Banjo Dan. Ooh, new nickname. I like that. Hey, Dan, tell me a little bit about sort of what convinced you to pursue a career in pharmaceuticals? Like as you were finishing your PhD and considering, you know, a career path, our listeners often ask us to talk about that a little bit. Tell us about your thought process there.
Yeah, sure. So actually, I think I had my mind made up pretty quickly, actually probably as early as undergrad, because I was a Merck intern back in 2005, 2004, 2005. I spent a couple summers actually in the medicinal chemistry department before I went to grad school. So I realized the impact of chemistry, I think, on people and on, you know, society as a whole, and just found the sort of application-based, applied chemistry science to impact world problems as being particularly useful. And then after going through the PhD program and the type of problems I worked on there, it didn't convince me otherwise. And I think I still found the applied chemistry in industry still a more rewarding experience overall.
Thanks, Dan. Hey, Artis, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, and what you do at Merck?
Sure. My name is Artis Klappars. I'm at Merck Process, been there for 18 years now. And only for some time I had also rotated in the catalysis group. So we share some of, I guess, career path with Dan as well here. And these rotations are very broaden our knowledge and horizons here. So, and they encourage in our department. So I think that that is a one interesting feature and useful feature in, I think, industry that you go there, you get to see a very wide range of field and expertise, and you can kind of adjust it to your own liking very much. So I got my PhD at Wisconsin with Ed Vedes, and then I moved to MIT working with Steve Buchwald on copper catalyzed coupling reactions, and then I moved directly to Merck and have been there since. And in terms of a fun fact about me, I like to grow vegetables, so I'm an avid gardener, so I have a farm to table every day pretty much.
Oh, what's in what do you got growing these days? It's October for
our
listeners.
Ready to pick my sweet potatoes.
Okay, are they special ones, like from a different country or
Oh, absolutely,
exotics?
Yeah. I have the purple ones from I think they originate in Hawaii or Japan. Cannot buy them in stores even. They're
of
dark
course.
Purple inside.
Really? That sounds cool. Wow, that's great. So thanks, guys. I mean, this work that we're talking about today was done in the context of the development of a commercial route to a compound called upifraspavir, MK-3682, which may be what we'll refer to it since that's a little bit easier to do. So this was an antiviral candidate for hepatitis C, and much of this work happened a while back. So Artis, can you tell us a little bit about the context, sort of when this happened, and a little bit more about this compound and sort of how we came to work on it?
Sure. Yeah. So most of the work that's related to the publications started around 2015, and around 2017, we kind of wrapped it up and after a demo on over 100 kilo scale. So that was a relatively fast development. And obviously the question is maybe the publication strategy. Why would we, I guess the first publication came out right around the time while we were working on it. We prioritized that because we felt that that would have a much wider impact on the community. And in fact, we did receive an EPA Green Chemistry Challenge Award for the dynamic phosphorylation chemistry. So we are very proud, and we also feel that it's a great feeling that we can influence maybe other projects as well with the chemistry that we develop. And the rest of the work, it's maybe a little bit like George R.R. Martin. So we get out the first Game of Thrones, get out the first books quickly and very successfully, but then takes a little while to get the rest of it finished and written.
I appreciate you building more upon that, because I was like, who is that? I feel sorry.
Yeah, it largely
let
depends
the suspense
on
build.
It largely depends on the prioritizations, because obviously writing publications is an important thing, part of what we do, but it's not our business goals. So we definitely appreciate an opportunity that we can publish our work, but we should also focus on our core business.
Okay, so to break the ice a little bit, get us loose and goosey for the rest of this pod, we have a fun quiz that neither of you have seen, but will leverage your expertise. So what was not shared is Dan is a home brewer and Artis is a fan of national parks. And so we have, through the genius of LC, he has merged these two concepts into a quiz, basically.
Yes. Yeah, it occurred to me that it would be really cool to do a quiz where we'll give you the name and you're going to tell us whether it's a national park or a craft beer. And so we'll take turns here. So the first one I will go with is Zion. National park or craft beer?
Who's the question for?
Or you guys can both give us your give us your answer, because we're gonna keep score to see which one of you gets it right.
National park.
Well, it's definitely a national park, but I mean, there are so many craft beers now that I wouldn't be surprised if there is one as well.
Okay,
go ahead, Dan.
Artists, are you saying both? It's both a national park and a craft beer, or?
I wouldn't be surprised. Definitely okay. The national park.
Artists is going with both. Dan is going with just national park. Okay.
So the Zion Brewing Company actually is a microbrewery. They make the Zion IPA, and you are right. Of course, there is the Zion National Park. So, Artis, you are right. That's both. Okay. The next one is Big Bend.
Big Bend is definitely a brewery. So, I'm definitely going to say a beer.
Well, it's definitely then both based on that. So. because I've been to I've been to all national parks so far that have been mentioned. So.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Okay.
So as a team, I guess you just figured it out. You're right. It's both. There's the Big Bend Brewery Company, and of course, there's the Big Bend National Park.
Okay. We only got a couple more, and then we can head on over to the rest of the pod.
Yeah. I'll go to Great Lakes.
Great Lakes is definitely one of my favorite breweries, so I know it's a brewery.
And it's definitely not a national park, so I guess
Boom.
It's a
boom. There we go. Teamwork makes the dream work. And last but not least, Neshaminy Creek, something close to home here in Rahway.
I have a keg of Neshaminy Creek in my kegerator right now. So
what?
There's definitely a brewery.
And it's definitely not a national park.
There you go. Again. Well, I think the conclusion here is with both your knowledge, we can get a Venn diagram that is a very accurate representation of what's a craft brewery and what's a national park.
Which segues really nicely into the rest of this podcast, because I think you two, complement each other to make some really sick nucleoside chemistry as well.
Yeah, I mean, these two papers focus on sort of two main challenges of making this molecule, right? The first is the synthesis of the nucleoside analog itself. This is a uridine derivative, which has, special substitution at the 2' position. And then the second is the installation of the protide, which is a prodrug, and the motif, which is installed at the 5' position. So, Dan, can you tell us a little bit about what a protide actually is? Just educate our audience a little bit about what does it do?
Yeah, absolutely. So the problem with most nucleosides is that their therapeutic window is not great, generally because of permeation into the cell. And so the prodrug moiety really allows it to cross the cell membrane, get into the cell where it can be triphosphorylated to the active nucleotide that is actually responsible for the activity. And that's usually generally what's limited, I think, the utility of nucleosides as therapeutics in general. So the prodrug that we were working on at the time for MK-3682 was a type of prodrug that was developed by Chris McGuigan at Cardiff, chiral P5 phosphoramidate moiety. And, this represented obviously a huge challenge from a stereochemical synthesis point of view at scale.
Thanks, Dan. Artis, can you, when this project first came in, there was sort of existing chemistry to install this moiety, but why is it that installing protides is so difficult? Can you tell us a little bit about what were the state-of-the-art methods when we started and sort of how we made progress towards this goal?
Yes, sure. So there are two challenges when installing protides. One is the chirality at phosphorus. One would think that there are other stereocenters in the molecule, so you could get the diastereoselectivity in the phosphorylation, but unfortunately, in our case, it was mismatched, so we had to overcome it. So one way to overcome it is to prepare a diastereomerically pure phosphorylating agent, and the standard case in literature was pentafluorophenyl ester. And that obviously, the disadvantage of that is that you have to make an isolated intermediate and you have to make sure that you upgrade the diastereomeric purity. But moreover, in our case, we also encountered the selectivity issue. There are two OH groups in uridine or related molecule, and we had selectivity issues between the 3' and 5'. We initially were able to overcome it by adding an aluminum salt, but again, we still had to make the diastereomerically pure phosphorylating agent.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes people don't appreciate the fact that any sort of step in a chemical process, even if it's to make something that ultimately doesn't end up in your molecule, is really going to create a lot of problems downstream. And in this case, while this method to sort of make the diastereomeric phosphorylating agent is fine, except pentafluorophenol, phenol, I should say, is actually really expensive, right?
Correct. And it's also difficult. It is also difficult to handle. It's a kind of low melting solid, and those are kind of things that only become issues when you start scaling things up. So you have to melt the low melting solid. That's an operational issue. It's also somewhat corrosive, toxic. So you have to overcome all of these considerations.
Great. So Dan, ultimately, you know, what the team decided to do is to develop a dynamic phosphorylation strategy. And this is really what the focus of this 2017 science paper is. And obviously, this obviates the use of a chiral phosphorylating agent. Can you give our listeners sort of what are the key design elements that went into how we designed the original screens for this reaction? Like, what were your thought processes to try to identify this?
Yeah, of course. So the chlorophosphoramidate, which is the precursor to these sort of stoichiometric already resolved pentafluoral phenyl reagents, kind of stood out to us as being the, you know, the right, most direct way to make this molecule. But of course, we had to find a catalyst that would be able to epimerize that P5 center and then also selectively recognize one of those as being more reactive and incorporated into our nucleoside. So, you know, the initial screening and development work really tried to find conditions that would allow us to basically catalyze a reaction without a significant background reaction. Because, of course, the original syntheses of these by McGuigan's group showed that, you know, you can affect this transformation with chlorophosphoramidates just with weak amine bases. And so it was sort of a special combination of very weak sort of proton scavengers like lutidine, which we eventually found, and also imidazole seemed to be the most catalytically active. And that combination allowed us to basically develop a, you know, fully catalyzed version without background. So that's where we ended up from the original screens. And then we obviously knew we needed to make this stereoselective, as the inherent stereoselectivity in that that coupling reaction was basically one-to-one. So there was no stereochemical induction from the chirality of the nucleoside itself.
I think it's really cool in the 2017 paper on this work is that, you know, there was a dimerization of this imidazole catalyst. And I guess, can you give us a little bit of background about what were like the initial insights that kind of led you down that path of dimerizing the catalyst and what the overall benefits were?
Yeah, so once we eventually identified, you know, a chiral framework that was useful for giving us selectivity for the desired prodrug, we did a lot of, you know, experimental, say, mechanistic work on that. And, you know, part of a sort of standard process chemistry optimization is a DOE type of experiment, design of experiments. It's a sort of statistical analysis that allows you to very quickly predict what the best conditions would be. And just based on the original DOE, we were able to show that the results were basically non-dose proportional to the amount of catalyst that we were adding. So by, say, doubling the catalyst, we were getting more than a doubling in the yield and in the selectivity. And that was pretty peculiar. So that's kind of how we originally picked up on it. But after, you know, bringing in some other folks that had really, you know, a good handle on, you know, running RPKA type experiments and other mechanistic studies, we were able to basically prove via kinetics that this was indeed a second order reaction in the catalyst. And that's really what, you know, teed us off to try to start making those type of dimerized structures.
So Dan, I mean, these dimers, you know, they sometimes can be hard to make and sometimes not. I mean, the one that we ultimately used was not that challenging, but if I remember correctly, sort of our initial attempts at dimerizing were actually pretty unsuccessful. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about that and sort of lessons learned from that experience and sort of takeaways when you get to that place where you say you're going to start dimerizing catalysts? What are things to think about?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is a really interesting thing to talk about because obviously all this doesn't get elaborated in the paper. It's something that, you know, you wouldn't really get the story unless, you know, I guess you hear it by word of mouth. But yeah, this was interesting because some of the initial catalysts that we had made, you know, I was a bit hesitant to start, you know, down this path of dimerizing catalysts. It seemed a bit like a long shot at the beginning. And we made some of these very simple ones, very close to the ones that we ended up using at the end. It turned out that there was a lot of sort of serendipitous things that happened in the course of a pretty short amount of time. And I think one of the things that made us miss some of the better results initially on these dimerized catalysts was due to solubility. So we were using pretty nonpolar solvents to try to achieve high selectivities like dichloromethane. And it turns out that as that catalyst reacts with the chlorophosphoramidate, those things tended to precipitate out of the reaction and the results were really poor. You know, at the time we were a little discouraged in that, and you know, we didn't know that was the only reason for, you know, the poor results. And so we started making more elaborate structures with chiropyridines on them because we thought maybe 2-aminosols was not going to be effective for a variety of reasons. And then we stumbled upon some other solvents, which were replacements for dichloromethane, you know, greener solvents. Those had significantly enhanced solubility properties of the intermediates. And we went back and made some of these catalysts, and then all of a sudden they started to really produce meaningful results.
Artis, let's pivot to your recent 2021 chemical science paper, which focuses on the synthesis of the nucleoside. I guess, what can you tell us about what the starting point for a commercial route was, and ultimately, what was the strategy being employed?
Yeah, so original route to this molecule started from glucose, and then it took about 12 steps to get to the final compound, going through various protections, deprotections, and also in the middle through glycosylation under relatively harsh conditions. And these are very standard conditions for making nucleosides, complex nucleosides. It's kind of like the more prevalent route. However, we were struck by how close the structure of our target is to uridine itself. And we decided to see if we can selectively functionalize uridine and access our target in a much shorter way.
I guess for our listeners, you know, you mentioned that the original route was from glucose. That seems like a really great, raw material to start with, but 11 steps and, you know, less than 2% overall yield. I guess, how does that compare to what an ideal route would be?
Yeah, obviously the ideal route is one step and maybe over 80% yield, but we usually consider it a good route over 50% overall yield. That's typically a good route. And obviously the step count, in an ideal case, you want to be less than 5 steps. That's kind of like a realistic good target.
Mm. Yep, that makes sense. So Artis, I mean, I remember when we sort of decided to go after uridine as a starting material and sort of directly functionalize it, right? And again, a lot of what's known about that is a lot of protecting group chemistry. Can you speak to some of the sort of critical breakthroughs or ideas that the team had that ultimately gave you a sense that this was going to be possible?
Yeah, the initial challenges we encountered with uridine itself. Uridine is a very polar molecule, not even very soluble in water because it's highly crystalline. So it's very difficult to work with it. And we had very hard time doing selective CH activation in the 3' position using either chemical or biocatalytic means. And moreover, we encountered instability of some of these key intermediates, such as keto uridine, when we oxidize one of the alcohol to a ketone. So we decided that we had to use a minimal protecting group strategy, and with something that's cheap and green and affordable. So we ended up using a pival oil as a protecting group. So that's maybe unusual in an academic setting. It's not so common, but for us, it was very much a perfect group. It's low molecular weight, cheap, non-toxic. But even then, we encountered migration of the protecting groups. So because you have all these hydroxy groups and the acyl groups just keep walking around. And we learned how to turn it to our advantage by finding a crystalline BF3 complex of one of these isomers that selectively crystallized out. And then we were able to intercept it and oxidize it to the desired ketone, and that was stable. So this kind of illustrates, again, maybe another difference where in pharmaceutical industry or in probably industry in general, that we tend to rely on crystalline intermediates for isolations and purity upgrades. Very much, good process is very much a process with good crystallizations. So it's a very, very important part of what we do.
Are you trying to tell us that you can't run a huge column all the time?
Yeah, huge column means a lot of waste, a lot of solvent, and we are very, very conscious about environmental impact. And environmental impact, obviously, one part is ethical. We don't want to destroy our environment, but it also has a business side, because almost every case, a green process is also the commercially most feasible process, the cheapest and the most scalable.
Artis, I remember when we first looked at the data from this screen, where we looked at a whole bunch of Lewis acids, bivalent metals, to try to form a chelate. At least that was the hypothesis, right? To form a chelate between the 2' position and the uracil, and somehow force the pivot oil. And it's like, it's one of those graphs where nothing works, and then there's like one perfect selectivity rate in the middle. I mean, how often does that happen? Like, is that common that you sort of have that one needle in the haystack, or do you think that that's that was just specific to this one?
I would say that it's more common than people would think. There have been many cases in my career where there's really just this one magical combination that gives a breakthrough. And that again emphasizes how important it is to do some sort of a high throughput experimentation. But obviously, every time you do high throughput experimentation, you have to come in with a hypothesis. As LC mentioned, in this case, we had a hypothesis. We'll have a Lewis acid that will coordinate to the alcohol and maybe another group in the molecule. So it's not just doing a lot of experiments, it's thinking and doing a lot of experiments.
I have to ask, okay, so HTE is great, but I think that there's also a component of having this like mental toughness, I guess, Artis. So like, what are your skills for like staying strong and motivated while trying to find that needle?
Yeah, I mean, you could say that every result, even a negative result, tells you something. That, to me, is the most mentally encouraging way to approach a problem. In many cases, a negative result leads to a Nature or a Science paper when you get something that you don't expect. So never discount your so-called failed reactions. Maybe that's the next Nobel Prize.
Oh, Artis, that's beautiful. You're so wise. You are.
That's so great. I think there's something to be said here. I mean, a lot of new methods are developed. And when they're published, people focus on how broad they are, right? And sort of how many substrates they can work on. But one of the things that is maybe a blessing and a curse of process chemistry is we often have a single target that we need a reaction to work on. So maybe that's the one thing that the reaction doesn't work for, or in this case, it's the one thing that it does work for, right? So I think that's maybe something for our listeners to take away is, obviously having a broad substrate scope is great, but when you need something to work on that one molecule, sometimes it actually comes in really, really handy.
Substrate scopes these days, bananas. Just have to add that in there. Like,
yeah,
out of this absolutely world. So I think this is our last question for the podcast today, and then, you know, we'll get you two out of here. Artis and Dan, looking back, is there anything that surprised you the most about the reactivity of nucleosides and any sort of discoveries that you made along the way?
What surprised me about this molecule that this was a molecule where we pretty much every step was chemical. We do have a large emphasis on biocatalysis in our more recent projects. And a lot, in fact, a lot of biocatalytic methods that we used in other projects had their origins in the work on this molecule. But it was a kind of, this was kind of an interesting case where this tertiary alkyl chloride being sterically hindered, and I guess as far away removed from nature as one can imagine, really challenged our biocatalytic approaches. And in the end, a purely chemical synthesis turned out to be the best way. So this still looks kind of surprising to me in retrospect.
Yeah, I'll add to that, that was a surprise to me as well. I mean, generally, the syntheses that are impacted the greatest from biocatalysis tend to be ones that look, that molecules that look like native substrates, and nucleosides are one of those that should, you know, seem to be easily put together by biocatalysts. And we did obviously try that, especially for the prodrug portion, and really got nowhere on that. It was really challenging. The other thing I will say is that what the properties of the nucleosides themselves were very difficult to work with. And I think that that's something, and how varying those properties were in solubility and reactivity. You know, the scope of, say, the end game phosphorylation was fairly broad, but we ran into a lot of problems when we tried to manipulate the nuclear base. The properties changed significantly, sometimes changing selectivity, sometimes just changing the solubility so much that you can't even get enough into solution. So although they all look fairly similar, their properties are extremely different. And I think that until you work on chemistry with these nucleosides, you don't appreciate how challenging it is to deal with all of their little nuances, from that perspective. So
they're like little people.
Yeah, they are.
Little difficult people sometimes, mm-hmm. Like real people.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot, guys, for coming on the podcast today. I really appreciate you guys giving us sort of a look behind the curtain on these two papers and on this project. It was really great having you, and we appreciate you guys taking the time.
And congrats on your award.
Thanks for listening to the Farm to Table podcast. This would not have been possible without our fabulous producer, Mark Partridge, and listeners like you. Be sure to check our episode credits, where you'll find more details about the show, as well as links to anything that we've discussed during the show.
If you find yourself craving even more info, you can find us both on Twitter. I am at Danny the Chemist, and LC can be found at Dr. LC Squared. But of course, our show also has a handle, and that is at Farm to Table Pod. Farm with a PH, in case you were wondering, where you'll find some behind-the-scenes action, future episodes and sneak peeks, and likely some random posts about chemistry, snacks, and whatever else.
Of course, we'd love to hear from you, so please interact with us on Twitter. Feel free to post any chemistry papers, Merck chemistry papers, that you found particularly memorable and that maybe you want us to build an episode around.
So stay tuned, folks.
Because on the next episode of the Farm to Table podcast...
We have a tendency to iteratively build these things. So as we talked a little bit about, my introduction to the field of biocatalysis really involved... transaminases that we engineered in the late 2000s to make chiralamines from ketones. It was just one step. We took one ketone starting material and made a product out of it. And from that one transformation, we built on that to to run dynamic kinetic resolutions, to do reductive aminations, and then ultimately to start stitching these kinds of transformations together into the process that we've been describing here for making complex nucleosides in a cascade fashion. So the next step, the next thing we're looking at are making even more complex molecules where we have collections of cascades that we put together to enable us to make even more complex molecules in ways that are remarkably efficient.